You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco and Lit Hub Radio, episode 187, The Neighbors. Today, for the first time in a while, we will tackle a single short story. We solicited our listeners via social media for a recommendation, and a couple of you directed us to The Neighbors by Shruti Swami, which is available online at Electric Lit and was published as part of her short story collection, A House is a Body. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need. We're Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hi, guys.
Hey!
Hi!
Hey. Nice to see all of you now that everything's fine.
It's a brave new world.
Everything's perfect in the world.
Yeah! We got through... So, our last episode, we talked to our good dear friend George Saunders, who all three of us have been hanging out with a lot.
Our best friend. Yeah.
So, last night I was talking to him and just like, you know, we were just sort of bullshitting about our fantasy football league. And, you know, just it's just so crazy how close we've become.
George Saunders in a fantasy football league sounds like a George Saunders short story. What does that look like? It's a post-apocalyptic football team. Half the team is robots. They're playing upside down in space.
I would absolutely read that. But our last episode with George, we had our last episode with George is also the name of our new podcast. We had just come through a violent insurrection.
Yeah, it's actually been a while. Yeah. We've taken a couple weeks off. Weeks off. We adjusted to inauguration.
But now that the world's better, everything seems fine.
You know what's interesting for me is that. And what I have to keep telling, I keep going to doom scroll, right? Like going to do the thing that I've been doing for 4 years, being dissatisfied by the lack of horrible Trump news to like click on and feel the outrage, and then realizing this is my problem and this is the challenge for all of our journalists out there and for our news media. Like we don't want that. Like I'm addicted to it, but it's actually better to not have that. And I'm going down like Washington Post and New York Times or whatever and clicking on the like fourth rate Trump story just because it's something there.
Give it to
and
me.
And I'm realizing
give it
just
to
stop.
Me.
Just stop. I don't need the fix.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and like one of the super soothing things I did is like the day after the inauguration, I watched the first press conference.
I know.
And I just had it played and I was like, oh, this is just the sound of governance, of a positive press, you know, spokesperson just talking about normal crap. And like, I've just been realizing like, I am so addicted to the, like the adrenaline rush that even the negative adrenaline rush. And like, I'm trying to just get into the zone of like, nope, now it's time to start reading more in-depth stories
right.
about really boring crap and like be okay with that and not need my political news addiction to inject that fury, which made me feel righteous. You know, it made me feel in a horrible way good, you know, because it like made me feel like I had an angle on the world that I could be sort of like determined about. Now it's like time to be determined about things that take a little more energy, a little more in-depth
I'm having
reading.
The exact same experience. Yeah. And the way I put it to some friends is like, I have to detox from this exact thought. I wonder what Trump thinks about this.
Right.
Like it actually started with the Twitter ban. I'm like, I need to know what he's saying about this, this, and this happening. And like, no, I don't. I just have to know that he's out there feeling whatever he's feeling and I don't get to know about it.
Yeah.
And that's good. Right. But it is a detox is the feeling that I've been having.
I was sitting in a small room in our house the other day where I sometimes go maybe three times a day called the bathroom. And I was...
Only three times a day?
Sometimes you...
Drink some water.
Sometimes you stand, sometimes you sit. Like, you're not on the phone when you're standing, Julia. This is the difference between boys and girls.
Okay.
Well, I mean...
We're always on the phone.
So I was like, oh, the New York Times... on my app has all these other sections.
Yeah.
Ooh, they have a really good arts and culture section. Every day they have new stuff.
Yeah, so my best feeling recently was I because during the pandemic I've been ordering books kind of at the same rate as I always do,
but not reading them.
not reading them. And I got a book in the mail and I sat down as soon as I got it and I read 50 pages in one sitting.
Oh, wow.
And it made me so happy. And I realized, like, right, that's where I need to be putting my energies right now. Like, just getting back to that. It's okay. Like, it's okay to take the time and, like, do this. Like, I don't need to be riled up constantly. It's really hard, guys. It's not easy.
Well, you know what is, I mean, to make it all about myself here for a moment, as I so rarely do on the show. So... I've got a book coming out. As listeners are listening to this, the book will already be out, but I have a book coming out in a week. And it feels kind of gross, like, during tumult to be promoting, you know, like, to be like, hey, oh my God, everyone's dying, everything's horrible, but did you see this review I got? It's starred, and it's boxed. So basically every day for the last 2 weeks, I've done some kind of media, an interview or a podcast, or I've written some piece or whatever. And I actually sort of, for the first time in 4 years, to be perfectly honest with you, feel like I can have frivolous thoughts when writing and talking about a book that's coming out, because I feel like, oh, there is a future ahead of us. Like, oh, there's a vaccine. There's a future ahead of us. At some point, the other side will be, back when everyone was sick, not back when everyone was well. That has allowed me to actually, like, be excited and happy that this book is coming out and I get to talk about it and meet people on Zoom instead of meeting people in the real life, which is a fucking bummer. But, like, it's really, really hard in other times, like, to be able to talk about the things that are bringing you joy when there's so much suffering. I mean, in general, there's so much suffering, but when there's specific suffering every single day on a macro level, it's hard to do those things. So, yeah.
Well, there's definitely still a lot of suffering.
Yeah, there's a ton.
But it does feel like there are grown-ups in the room.
Yes, God.
Like, maybe we have a government right now, like that. You know, just it's mind-boggling that
Joe Biden has
gone through this pandemic
the way
we have.
Joe Biden is super calming. Like, he wasn't my pick from the start. I was Elizabeth Warren, and I've got the sign in my garage to prove it. But I got to tell you, man, like, when he's out there and he's talking, I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's nice. Yeah, right there. That's a good spot. I'm like when you find that spot on your dog and they just, like, they become totally incapacitated. That's how I am when Joe Biden's talking. Like, oh, yeah, right there. Yeah, right there. Right. Yeah, go.
So true.
Which is nice. And it opens up my mind to be able to actually, like, read a little short story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's a nice segue.
And think about it and ponder it.
Well, it's funny. This short story actually did kind of take me back in a way. I don't know how you guys feel, but I haven't read a story that's sort of like this in a while.
Yeah.
I feel like first of all, I haven't been reading short stories that much. I haven't been reading anything that much, but these kinds of short stories, this sort of, like, even-handed, very subtle... and short and, I guess it's in the Carver tradition in a way, you know, that sort of, like, if you read it too fast, you might completely miss what's going
exactly.
on.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't read that kind of story in a long time. This is, like, what I feel like when we were getting our MFA, this is what I was reading all the time was like this kind of short story. Maybe because that's what everyone writes in an MFA program, but, it was also what we were reading or what we were being taught. And, I'm sure Todd, you can speak to this a lot, because I'm sure you teach these kinds of stories all the time, but it was actually really refreshing to read it, this kind of story again, and be like, oh right, there's this calm, really you have to lean into it, I guess, you know, you can't just, like, you can't just let it happen to you.
Well,
you have to, like, really dive into the story. It requires close reading.
It requires super close reading, but unlike Carver, and I get what you're saying. It's a realist short story. But right. Carver and his ilk were minimalists, and right. Shruti Swami is not. I mean, this is a story that is super layered. It's layered in colonialism. It's layered in sexism. Mm-hmm. It's layered in racism. Mm-hmm. It's layered in American class issues, all sorts of stuff in about 3,400 words. Yeah. She does a really but just like you said, if you're not paying attention to this, you got to read every single line. Because every single line has a startling revelation. And the moment, we should describe what it is, but the moment that I knew that I had to really pay attention when reading the story comes in the first paragraph. It's just a line I'm going to read. My son gazed up at the trees in wonder, still small enough to look slightly absurd, almost like a fish with the gaping mouth and eyes. But then he would move his head a little bit, wave his arms, and he would look suddenly startlingly human. And I was like, oh, he is human. He is human. So if the narrator of the story is looking at your child and thinking, oh, he looks startlingly human, there's going to be real fucking problems in the story with this narrator. And that's when I was in. I was like, oh, let me go back the previous four lines and start reading this again. Because we're in the hands of a real master. And so I was really interested. But also I was thinking about it in terms of the Russian stories we read with George Saunders. And there's a little bit of an influence there too, clearly. Because she's coming down that same tree that a lot of us learned on. And so I'll be interested to hear about that. But yeah, it was great just to sit down and read a short story and really sort of think about things in the world as it relates to a closed ecosystem, like a plotless story about a brief interaction.
Yeah.
So have we described exactly what happens?
No,
we
have not. Julia, would you like to
do that? Not a whole lot. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Julia, would you like to summarize?
Sure. A young mother of an 8-year-old and a baby, she's hanging out, and
she's hanging out.
She notices she's
going to raves.
You know, she has a complex relationship with her daughter, often at odds. She is married, but we get no scenes with the husband awake. He's mentioned as sleeping. She notices that new neighbors have moved in next door. Then she observes them. The neighbors come by with cookies. They have one of those really mundane conversations in a living room, and then their daughters play together in the neighbor's yard. I'll do the big spoiler reveal. Listeners, this is your warning. You can go read the story if you want before I say the only major event that happens or doesn't happen in the story is the narrator tries to reveal bruises on her neck to the new neighbor. The new neighbor doesn't even notice. And then the narrator's daughter trips and falls, humiliates herself, and runs home. The end. Did I get it all?
Yeah, no, it's actually pretty remarkable how little happens in this story, and yet it's still pretty enthralling.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, but you forgot to mention, Julia, that when the new neighbor comes over, with the pale cookies, the narrator notices that the new neighbor has a black eye.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is important.
Yes. Very.
Now, as I was reading the story, I was thinking about you guys and about your kids and about how, like, your kids are always, like, running around and jumping on you and beating on you and all kinds of stuff, and that it must be tough with a kid, like, to explain away things like black eyes on you or a dislocated wrist or something. And, like, that was at first when I was reading the story, when the woman shows up at the door with a black eye, I was like, oh, God, her baby must have popped her one. And then as I kept reading, I was like, oh, you're an idiot. Like, that's probably not what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I read it as domestic abuse, like, or immediately.
Me too.
But then I do feel like that actually gets questionable later, you know, like, because there's also this weird sequence where our narrator wakes up in the middle of the night to the sound of glass breaking, and then she goes to the window and sees a blonde man in the street, but then it's kind of like, was that just a dream? Like, was he actually there? It's a little So it's really, I feel like it's left a little open as to whether the other character, the Louisa, is that mm-hmm. her name? Or Louis? Yeah, Louisa. Whether Louisa, the white woman who moved in, is actually experiencing abuse. I think that is left a little open. But either way, you know, our narrator is experiencing right. abuse and wants to share, you know, wants to reach out for help, essentially, or recognition at least, and doesn't get it, which also feels wrapped up in race and immigration, mm-hmm. because we learn that our narrator is an immigrant still trying to get her citizenship
from India, and
there's a very complicated series of conversations, or not a series, a couple conversations with her daughter about how her daughter, you know, gets along in this world with other kids and the new neighbors, and relates to her body and her hair. Yeah. There's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on in a little space. And, you know, when you're reading, so it's also, it's both an unreliable and a super reliable narrator at once. She tells you exactly what's happening, but she does it in subtext, which makes her a little bit unreliable. Because you don't know quite when she's lying and when she's not. But all of the clues that she gives you about her life, the way that the author has written it lends itself to the reader doing the exact same thing that the new neighbor does, which is ignore her.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that is the absolute... artistry of this short story. That's why when I read that line, he looks startlingly human, I was like, okay, this is one of these stories where you have to read every single, I mean, you should read every single line anyway, but let's be honest, we all skip. where you got to really pay attention to every single line, because there is something nested, some darker truth nested in each line. And so there's a point very early on in the story when the neighbor does come to visit with the cookies. And the narrator reveals that no other neighbors ever come anymore. So there's that she's like the person you avoid in the neighborhood. There's also an interesting thing. They live in Eichlers. I don't know if the average reader knows what an Eichler is. Do you know what an Eichler?
I didn't know what that was. No.
So Eichlers are these strange little modernist homes. They're all in the East Bay. There's some, I guess, that are closer to San Francisco itself. But he was a modernist builder. Where I grew up in Walnut Creek, there's a whole neighborhood of Eichler homes, and they were built to be like the homes of the future. And in the 1970s and 1980s, they were these worthless houses because no one cared about modernist design. They have two front doors, which is interesting, because they have a front door and then they have a courtyard front door. So it depends where you enter the house. I thought she might do something with that because it's, you know, a strange thing about displacement. She just said, oh, we live in Eichlers. But these Eichler neighborhoods that used to be worth nothing, in the 21st century, when people became super interested in modernism, these homes you couldn't sell became worth millions and millions of dollars. And so it's an interesting sort of parallel to like what used to be valuable and then stopped being valuable and is valuable again, like the way someone's hair looks versus their mind, which is a conversation that the narrator has with her child. The narrator feels bad because her child, her daughter, is a reader. And she says, as soon as my daughter began to become a reader, I lost her to her mind. And you're like, oh shit. Like, you want your child to read, right? Isn't that like, you want that, right? You too, you guys want your children to read.
Definitely.
But these, you know, that they live in these modernist homes and they're having sort of a 1950s conversation where everyone avoids the reality of the situation, I thought was a very deft bit of writing. And it could be that it's not even intentional on her part, but I saw it that way. Like, oh, you're living in a 1950s neighborhood, having a 1950s conversation with actual modern people doing the same things they would have done in 1956. Ignore the Indian woman and the obvious bruises on her neck from being choked. Don't ask her any questions. She doesn't exist. She's not real. And so I really appreciated that sort of subtlety. But if you don't know what an Eichler home is, you're just going to skip right by it.
So I feel like where a lot of the artistry came in for me and is going towards your reliability question, Todd, is I feel like this story did an incredible job of demonstrating how she internalized this abuse and is taking it out on her daughter and her judgments of the other woman. So, like, and these things are so subtle, which is why they feel internalized. Like, she admits that she's, like, shocked that this woman has short hair. She is pressuring her daughter to please others with the way she looks and acts. And all of those are, you know, secondary, you know, like the waterfall cascading down of being controlled and being abused. Whereas on the surface, it just looks like a normal nagging mom. But we know that there's this like powerful force in their family. And it's funny, like the daughter is equated to the husband a few times. And, you know, I wonder if that line that you pulled out, Todd, is indicating, you know, when she started to read, you know, the narrator lost her ally, you know, her daughter, the only person that she's with. I mean, I want my daughter to read, but I also love how entwined we are right now. Right. And there is this loss as they get further from you. And so, yeah, she's completely isolated. And then she's taking out these judgments that have clearly been, you know, given to her. And she's taking them out on everyone around her.
Right. Right. And, you know, I think... to go back to what we mentioned at the top of the show, thinking about the conversation we'd had about the Russian short stories with George Saunders, where he talks about setting up expectations, right? That opening paragraph sets up that expectation for what the story is going to be about, this disassociation with her own self and with her own children, that she is somehow losing them, like losing the ability to recognize them as people anymore. And so throughout the story, the narrator constantly is reminding herself to basically act human around her children when in front of other people, which is such a, you know, a startling bit of narrative. But she also herself is going through a change. So in the middle of the story, she's talking about how the new neighbor has short hair and how surprised she was that the neighbor had short hair, which, you know, seems like people have short hair periodically. And she said, "Of course, I lost quite a bit of my hair after my two pregnancies, which my gynecologist told me is common. For a while, I thought my hair would grow back, but it never did. Then I began to comb it less frequently. Sometimes I forgot for days. I had remembered today because of the woman and her short hair, which had shocked me." So she's doing this strange mirroring thing now, too. Like, I forget to comb my hair until the beautiful girl moved in. And I want to be her. I want to have her face. I will wear her skin as a mask. That'd be a Stephen Graham Jones.
I was going to say, then it becomes a Stephen King story.
So I thought that was a yet another strange little turn where you start to realize nothing's quite what it seems.
This is a sort of meta point. But I really couldn't read this online. I had to print it out. I could not. And I guess that's a me problem. Like, it was interesting. Like, I feel like I can read some stuff on screen, but for whatever reason, when I got to like the third paragraph of the story, I was like, nope, this is too, I need to like have this on paper and I need to be able to like turn a page. And, I don't know. I just found, I don't know. How did you guys feel? Did you read it online? You read it on screen?
Yeah, I did.
And it was totally
fine.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah. I think for me, because I often feel like that writer, but the language is so straightforward. I don't know. Somehow that made it okay. And it was short, of course.
Right.
But yeah, I get it. I mean, reading online is horrible. I think there are studies that, you know, you're not really reading the same way. Mm-hmm. We've probably talked about this before.
Well, you don't remember it the same way, apparently. Like, I think that's what I've heard, at least.
Yeah, and you don't, and you skim a little bit more, which this, there's no point to skimming this. You'd be like, wow, a random scene about nothing.
Right.
Yeah. But I guess that's, like, to me, you know, I guess what I was thinking about reading this story is, in general, is the subtlety. You know, like, in so many ways, I love it. Like, I think that is like the highest art form, right? To be able to be subtle. And then other times I'm like, who is this for? Like, you know, it's for really like the readers out there, right? Like people like us who want to lean in And I just get fascinated by this question of like literature that is maybe too subtle, or you know, I mean, this is not her fault at all as an author, and I don't, you know, I'm just curious about like how there's been so many great stories written about things like abuse and colonialism and racism and sexism and all the stuff that's like packed into a story like this. And I just like, I want it to reach other people. Like I want, like, how do you get stories like this out there? And how do we get people to start reading stories closer? You know, like how, because we're all like, man, this is speaking for myself. Like I am so used to not reading these kinds of stories anymore. Like now, and this is going back to what I was saying earlier about wanting those Trump stories to give me that little, like, I'm so worried that my brain is getting attenuated to like spikes, and like that, you know, I want my entertainment to be as flashy as possible or as extreme as possible. And when I read something like this, I'm just reminded of like, oh, right. And the Russian Masters that we were reading in the George Saunders thing, I'm like, right, subtlety and slower paced, mm-hmm. and like having to lean in is so important. And I just want to like spread that message somehow. And I don't, you know, we have to keep talking about that because I'm losing it in myself. And here I am, a 41-year-old, very experienced reader who loves these kinds of things, and yet I can't read it on a screen. I have to print it out. And I don't know, like I said, maybe that's just me, but.
Well, I mean, you're talking about, I mean, we talked about this years ago, actually, about, you know, the short story is fine art, basically. And mm-hmm. and how, you know, you don't look at Picasso's every single day of your life, but when you see one, you really appreciate it. But they, most of the Picasso's, to really appreciate, you got to be up in front of it inside of a museum. And so right. the odds, writer, of you stumbling on this short story inside Electric Literature on a summer day in July when it first appeared is almost zero, you know? Like, you got to want to be looking for it. But that being said, you know, there's plenty of people that are reading these stories. You know, her book was widely hailed. She publishes in all the interesting and good places. But the fact of the matter is that the short story is still, you know, way down low on the list of things that most people read on a regular basis. The short story mm-hmm. and poetry are probably about the same. But, you know, sort of interestingly enough, when I was working on my new book and we were deciding what to call it and all this stuff, I had a conversation with my editor and I was like, hey, look, we need to put something on the cover that lets people know that this isn't a sad book of short stories about people staring into the middle distance. Like,
because you were afraid that would mean nobody.
Because I was afraid no one would buy it.
Yeah, which is the reality.
Right. So I was like, we need to put on the front cover something that says like, this is some gangster shit, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or else no one's going to pick this book up. They're just going to think it's sad stories about people in a desert. And so now on the cover, it says gangster stories. Mm-hmm. And like that tells the reader, oh, these are going to be plot heavy, action filled stories, you know, with lots of violence and stuff in it. Now, that being said, there's plenty of stories that are in that book that are just people sitting quietly and thinking about the ways they fucked up their lives. But in order to actually get someone to pick up the fucking book and buy it, I felt like, well, I need to distinguish myself from, you know, the Paris Review short stories and let people know this is not that kind of thing. So, you know, part of it is a marketing thing. Like, how do you get great literature to the people that really want it, particularly now when people aren't walking into a bookstore and there's not a table full of curated stuff. You got to find this stuff on your own for another, you know, few months at least. And I don't think anyone has a solid answer for it. You run an excerpt in Electric Literature and hope that it that it goes viral. I mean, Electric Lit's a very popular website. It gets, you know, a couple million hits a month.
I also like, they also have that intro because mm-hmm. it was a selection from another author sort of introducing it, mm-hmm. which, you know, I skip stuff like that because, mm-hmm. in this case, I knew I was going to read the story anyway. So I read it after, but it's really nice to have somebody be like, read this story for this reason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, here, you know, big arrow. I mean,
it's what we're doing. I don't know if you're aware of it.
But yes, I know. Well, but, you know, I just want to jump in on what Todd was saying. Like, that's what I love about bookstores, right? And that's what I feel like is getting lost, is that we don't have that space. Libraries and bookstores are that space where you walk in as a especially as a kid, but certainly as any age, you walk in and you're like, what should I read? And somebody behind the counter is well-read and has taste and can listen to what you have to say and just be a human saying, check this out. Because that's changed my life, you know, mm-hmm. or even just putting, you know, there's always that rack in independent bookstores that's not Barnes & Noble, where it's not paid for by the publisher, but it's, you know, the employee picks. Selection, you know, a staff picks. Exactly. Right. Like that is, I can't tell you how many great books I never would have found if they weren't for staff picks. And like, I'm so worried about this vanishing culture. Anyway, sorry. Go on, Julia.
Oh, no, first of all, I've mentioned this years ago, so newer listeners probably didn't hear this, but there was an entire year where every single thing I read, when I was living in New York, I walked into Three Lives and Company, which is a tiny famous bookstore, and I just had the same staff member give me a new book like once a week. It was the best year of reading of my entire life, and I'm still friends with her. So cool. But what I was going to say, Ryder, is like I do think you're poking at something even bigger, which is, you know, we're becoming, and this goes back to the Trump stuff, you know, less and less comfortable with reading something if we don't know ahead of time how it's going to make us feel. Right. You know, like we want to know, like, is this a sad one? Is this something with a message? Is this like, I need to laugh. Find me something that's going to make me laugh. And this permeates all genres. I mean, like essays about parenting, which, by the way, this is also a short story about parenting, mm-hmm. Which we haven't talked about at all. But like, there's
this voice.
Which is also
why I picked it for you guys to read.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot. There's like this voice in what I will call like online mommy essays, that it's like this ubiquitous voice that they all share. And even though they're like dealing with really heavy or important issues, like it always comes back to like, but it's all good because I love my kid, or I learned this lesson. And that impulse is very human, but it has become one voice, whereas to like put an essay or a short story out that's just like, yes, here's how it is. And honestly, even like, here's how it is, that's too direct of a message.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
do you
like
remember
this
when,
is what parenting is like is not a great message.
Do you remember
either.
When
this is just one singular character story?
Do you remember when Ilette Waldman put out that essay about parenting? Ilette Waldman, who's also married to Michael Chabon, and she wrote an essay where she was like, I love my husband more than I love my children. That's just how
it
is.
Yeah, and people went crazy.
And it was like, go get her!
Yeah.
So I think there's a real hesitancy, like even if people want to be honest about that stuff, they're like, well, I could write it or I could have a happy life.
100%. But there's so much of this writing out there. Like when people cross into the parenthood threshold, it's like the truth. I have to write about it. I have to, you know, express myself in this way. And I completely admire that impulse. And I write about parenting and I like writing about parenting. But it's very hard not to fall into this weird churning, like, conversation that's always on.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but this is a short story that is about parenting. But there's a real obvious darkness to it. And so I was kind of curious from both of your perspectives. I'm not a parent, but I had one in the same neighborhood as where this is taking place. How it felt for you guys?
Honestly, maybe this is really messed up. I thought this was pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Like the feeling of, you know, I'm disconnected to these people, but I'm also these little people, but I'm also like very frustrated with them. And why won't they just do what I say? And like watching them sleep and all of that is just right on. Like if the domestic abuse was not in the story, this would be like just everyday loneliness. Like the disconnection and the loneliness of being a parent alone all day with your kids is present here in a way that I think a lot of parents would recognize and connect with.
I really, you know, probably because my son is right at the age, he's six, and I really connected to trying to communicate about presentation socially and self-confidence. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is so tough because it's like, you know, I'm getting to the point where like, I'm like, like Indy should not be wearing sweatpants every day. Like, can we dress him up a little nicer? You know? And it's like, but no, he wants to be comfortable. And it's like, yeah, okay, well, he wants to be comfortable. Who gives a crap? You know? And so, you know, obviously in this story, it is so much more fraught because it's about her hair. And I think, you know, it's got a lot of ethnic overtones and undertones. It's just, it's shot through. But I, you know, I have had conversations with parents where, I mean, I've watched a parent say something about her son that seemingly as innocuous in front of her son is, well, he doesn't have a strong forehead. And you know, and I've just been horrified because it's like, you can't say crap like that. Like, no, you know, but it is a delicate balance because you're, you know, you like, we all want our kids to be these sort of perfect, confident, like dream versions of ourselves. And then they go out in the world and they're not. They're maybe social messes. They're too whiny. They're a bully or they're being bullied, you know, and it's really an intense experience that I'm trying to contend with because like, you know, I think we all have like rose colored lenses about our own childhood, or at least maybe I do, where I'm just like, well, I was always a happy kid and I was super confident. And I was like, no, I wasn't like, I, you know, but I watch my son starting to interact and starting to develop his own personality. And it's just, there's so much tension there. And I thought the story, you know, figured like got to that really, really well. And then, like I said, also brings in this, you know, these questions of like, you know, ethnic identity, which like, man, the amount of literature and film and stuff that I've encountered, I think we all are starting to encounter more and more about hair mm-hmm. as a sort of central mm-hmm. issue is really interesting. And I think it's so true. Like, I think that a big part of white supremacy has been hair suppression.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. I first encountered it when I started dating my wife, who has very, very ethnic hair. You know, she's Puerto Rican, but you know, we did the genetic tests relatively recently and she's 25% African. She has very African, tight, thick hair. And she always hated her hair. And it's always been a thing. It's like my fucking hair, you know? And, you know, part of that is being an actor and always going on to these shows where she's the only non-white person on the show. And the hair people, as nice as they are always like, ugh, your hair. And it's only been relatively recently, like, you know, right now she's on a show called All American, which is a predominantly black show. And she shows up and the hairdresser is like, I know what to do with your hair. And she's like, thank God. And she's finally starting to not feel bad, mm-hmm. you know, and not feel like this, you know, internalized thing about her freaking hair. And it's like, yeah, you shouldn't feel bad. It's your hair, you know, but whatever. And, you know, it's an issue that keeps coming up. God, there was a great horror film, and I'm forgetting the name of it right now, that I saw at Sundance last year.
While you think of that, Jesse, I'm going to recommend an essay, and I'll put a link up to it up on our Twitter. Susan Strait, the wonderful author Susan Strait, she has biracial children, and she wrote a beautiful essay several years ago about their hair and about doing their hair and about learning how to handle their hair. And it's just... Yep. Absolutely stunning, and it talks actually a lot about the stuff Ryder just talked about, but also stuff that's in the story and about hair as an expression of personal identity, but also its connection to a larger and more profound history. So I'll find that and I'll put it up on our Twitter. You guys can go look for it when you're done listening to this episode.
Sorry, I couldn't remember the name because it's very obvious. It's a movie called Bad Hair. It's awesome. It's so fun. It's basically like a horror comedy, like a really over the top horror comedy about a woman who gets a possessed weave, and it's just all about this. But it's, you know, it's Justin Simeon who created Dear White People, and you know, it's very much, I'm assuming it's out and available now. I saw it at Sundance last year, and my last big journey, you know, out in the world before pandemic hit. And it was one of the funnest movies I saw there. But it finds a way, you know, via like the same avenue as like Get Out, you know, to address mm-hmm. this in a very over the top, fun. It's not as good of a movie as Get Out, but it's still a very fun movie. But you know, I just feel like the issue of hair, especially in the black community, is so, it's such an interesting way into these issues. And anyway, this story, I thought, you know, even in just a couple, there's only like, it's what, like three paragraphs about it, but it really resonated on the same level.
Yeah. I mean, it's huge. It's huge. Identity. And, you know, when we have, when we say things, well, when people go into like battle with hair or battle with pieces of your body that are just natural and normal, you know, like, therefore begins the self-loathing.
Right. God, yes.
You know, from your mother. I think the most important thing anyone said to me right before I had Vega was, like, a friend just mentioned offhand, like, oh, what you say will become her internal monologue for the rest of her life.
Oh, it's so true.
And
oh,
I was like, it blew my mind, and I think about it all the time. And now that she's talking in, like, paragraphs, she just says fucking everything I say, you know? So, you know, we think, like, we need to teach our kids in a certain way. Say, like, you are beautiful, you are smart, whatever. But instead, we have to speak kindly about ourselves or just zip your fucking lip. speaking of the women here, like, don't ever say, like, I'm fat, or I hate this, I hate that about yourself, because that's what they're going to do, you know? And, like, breaking that cycle of self-loathing or humiliation and anger is all in this story in this really real little way.
Like, the last scene of this story.
Yeah, it ends on that note, right?
Ends on,
it seems to be kind of where it
ends on humiliation, on simple humiliation, a thing that happens to kids all the time. They trip and they fall, like.
Right.
I do that.
Yep.
I do that on a regular basis now. but so the narrator's daughter tells her, "Oh, the neighbors' kids are all running around in the sprinklers in the front yard. Can I go?" And so she walks her daughter down, and they are running around in the sprinklers. And the daughter trips and falls and lands face first. And it's like, the most humiliating thing that's ever happened to the mother is that her daughter fell. It's not humiliating for the daughter. It's humiliating for the mother. And it reminds...
Oh, it's humiliating for both of them.
Well, it's humiliating for both, but, you know, in the course of a human life, it won't be the worst thing. But I was reminded of... I don't know if you guys ever watched that TV show, Designing Women. I have a weird love for Designing Women. I don't know why. But there was an episode where one of the characters says, "What's the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to you?" And she said, "When my sister walked out on the runway with toilet paper stuck to herself." It's like, the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to you is something bad that happened to your sister.
Yeah, but I do think that, like, the point is that, like, the daughter might not ever remember this moment, but it builds a
foundation,
a story, right? It's building a foundation of, I am not right. I do not fit in. I am not as cool and suave and pretty and in control as the white girls down the street who are, you know, masters of their own domain and have no problems. And I also, like, in that scene, my favorite part is when her daughter says, "I like cats."
And then
the narrator says, "She's allergic to them," and hates them. And you're like, oh, right. You know, and I've definitely, like, I've seen my son do things like that, or say things like that, where you're like, that's not true. But then I'm like, I'm not going to correct
that. No.
Like,
let's
just let this one go as he navigates the world socially and has to build a sort of narrative of self that is experimental and is going to fall on his face and get up and hopefully, you know, not internalize to the extent that I'm afraid this narrator's daughter might actually internalize it. But you're always, as a parent, you're always like, oh my God, I mean, this is so ridiculous. But my son was part of a little kid rock band music class where it's less about the music than it is about learning to, like, be a part of a band.
Right.
And, like, they all learn one song over the course of, you know, several months, and then they do a show, like a full-on rock show. Oh, it's amazing. And it was so cool. Like, you know, we had friends who had done it with their kids who were slightly older, whatever. So we found out about it and put my son into it. And then, you know, he loved it. He was three and a half at the time. So it's really young to be, you know, but they get up on stage and he was the keyboard. So he has, like, the three notes he's supposed to play. And, you know, he had been so into it, like, throughout all the rehearsals, because rehearsals was just the six kids get it together and learning about, like, tempo and volume. And these are the notes you hit on the guitar. Or this is the, you know, and a lot of the kids just wanted to sing, but my son wanted to play the piano. And, oh my God, when it came time for the rock show, which was at a like an actual rock venue down the street from our house in our neighborhood, which is pretty, it's a real club.
Cool. I feel very tense.
Yeah.
My wife was out of town. She had to work. So I was alone. Luckily, like my brother and some friends came to support me. Not my son supported me because I was a wreck. I was so nervous for him. And, you know, and like I've since like been much better, like at other sort of kid performance, singing, dancing events that he's been a part of. But this was the first one at like 3 and a half, and I just lost my shit. I was so, and it's like one of these things I've had to learn is just like, okay, he's got to, you know, let his pressure be his own pressure and let him, because I don't, you know, I can't put my own stuff on him. And this is something my wife and I talk about all the time. It's like, all right, how much of what we're putting on him is our issues and how much of them are, you know, just going to be his and like finding that balance. And you never will, right? I mean, we all fuck up our kids to some extent in some way, but we just constantly have to be calling each other out on like, I think that's about you, not about Indy. And like, that's a constant discussion. And I know it's only going to get worse as he gets older.
You should absolutely give Alex the short story and have her read it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I should.
This could be you.
Well, since I printed it out, it's very easy to walk in the next room and hand it to
read
her.
This. This is about you.
Read this.
Oh my God.
I know. Let me tell you about your hair issues. Yeah, I'm sure she needs that, right?
Oh God. So the last thing I just want to say about the story is I just love that it's a quiet, risky short story that actually had me turning the page thinking there might be something more. And I love a short story that ends on an ellipses and not on a period. And this is a story where you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? But you know what's going to happen next. You know what these people's lives are going to look like. And I just love that. I mean, that's what the best short fiction for me has always done, is give me a peek into someone else's life and make me worry about them like they're real people afterward. And it's a really unique skill that that the author, Shruti Swami, has to do it in a story that is, like I said, largely plotless. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens in the story. And it's super powerful.
But everything happens.
It's super powerful. And I really can't wait to read her collection. You know, I feel bad because I'd never heard of her prior to this moment. And then I was like, well, God, the story collection got great reviews. And it's got a great title and a great cover. Why didn't I hear about it? Oh, it came out in July of 2020 when the world was on fire. And the world is still on fire. But like, this is what I was talking about before. Like, man, there was a whole year where we just missed a lot of culture. Though we had the ability to consume as much as we wanted, it turns out. But I was actually sort of reminded of, what's her name? Carmen Machado's short story collection.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Very similar kind of story. Well, I mean, she was writing fairy tales in a way, but, the power in which she writes,
Well, even the title, A House is a Body, is also reminiscent of the way that she, you know, used the, using the female body as a sort of entry point for stories. Really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I just think she's
literary disco.
Oh, never mind.
I thought that was my cue.
Whatever. I was just going to heap praise on you. Sorry, Shruti. Writer's done. Nope, I'm it.
Go for it, Todd. What were you going to say?
I don't have anything to say. I'm waiting. She's great.
Buy her book. Find it at an independent bookstore if you can. Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.